This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for a world-class music festival in the heart of the French Quarter, an ancient Greek tragedy with a modern-day spin, or a surreal exhibit from a reclusive sculptor, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. The largest showcase of Louisiana music on the planet will attract visitors from around the globe to New Orleans as the 33rd annual French Quarter Festival presented by Chevron opens this week. It's the kickoff to the festival season, and spokeswoman Marcy Schramm is here to fill in the details. Welcome.
Thank you.
This is a festival that just keeps growing with the years. Tell us about the growth and why it has such a diverse appeal.
Well, French Quarter Festival, by the numbers, is kind of awesome in so many ways. We're in our 33rd year. We've grown to over 700,000 people. We, you know, generally have been averaging 500,000 to 700,000 people. And according to our economic impact study, it's about half locals and half visitors. So what started as a locals festival really has grown into a major tourism event for New Orleans. The economic impact has been shown by the UNO Hospitality Research Center to be over $250 million. And that's second only to Mardi Gras, which is awesome. Certainly, it's not the same festival it was 30 years ago. It's just not. The word is out. People know about it.
So what's new this year? What can we look forward to?
You know, this year, we didn't look to reinvent the wheel. We were just looking for a solidly good, strong lineup, really interesting programming, really strong children's programming. And so we've got a lot of Louisiana musicians that are just crowd pleasers. We've got Cowboy Mouth. We've got Buckwheat Zydeco, Sonny Landreth. Of course, people like the Dixie Cups that are just so beloved. Jean Knight, who's known for her hit Mr. Big Stuff. In Jackson Square, Ellis Marsalis, followed by Delphael Marsalis. People like Devel Crawford. Just really phenomenal jazz music.
And you have some unique events in addition to the music associated with the festival.
There's a lot of special events within the event, which is one of the things I love the most. Some of the real classic things are, Dancing at Dusk, where everyone dances in the street on Royal Street to a big band. Battle of the Bands, which is traditional jazz bands duking it out on the steps of the Supreme Court building. And then our kids' areas are really significant. We've got an amazing children's area with a stage up on the riverfront on the Natchez Wharf. It's the majority of it is the Chevron STEAM Zone, and STEAM, of course, is science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. So it's very educational, but it's also so much fun. And then another kids' area over at the Herman Grimma House, which is a beautiful house museum in the French Quarter. And we take over their gorgeous courtyard with a lot of really interesting educational kids programming. Like, it's all the museums, the Louisiana State Museum, the Contemporary Art Center, New Orleans Museum of Art, Longview House and Gardens, people like that doing really great kids' activities.
Now, you can't have a festival in Louisiana without food.
We have some really awesome new foods. It's kind of rare that we have openings. A lot of our vendors have been with us 30 plus years and they don't ever move, which is great. But we had a few openings this year. And in addition, we've got, for the first time ever, we're putting food on Spanish Plaza. So we've got some new vendors up there. But we're welcoming Andrea's, wonderful Italian cuisine. We've got the Big Cheesy doing these gourmet grilled cheese sandwiches, which are unbelievable. We have Redfish Grill is introducing some new menu items that are just fabulous. We've got down at the Mint, the Cafe Reconcile doing some new items. We have the return of the second year Plum Street Snowballs. We'll be doing adult snowballs, which is kind of fun. We'll be calling them spirited snowballs, so something fun for the adults as well as the kids. And the food is awesome. Some of the classic famous restaurants of New Orleans are serving fine cuisine at our festival.
You have a very special tribute this year to the late great musician Alan Toussaint.
We do. When we lost him last fall, it was shocking and it was heartbreaking. And we all want to do something and pay tribute to a man who just changed music as we know it and gave so much to this world and was just such a gentleman. I mean, he's so beloved around the world. We have a series of events to honor Alan Toussaint at our film festival. We'll do a screening of a new documentary about him that's at Le Petit Theater. And then at our symposium down at the Old U.S. Mint, we are doing a tribute to Toussaint. We'll have Irma Thomas, Alan's son Reggie, some other great musicians who played with him talking about his life and his work. And then also there's a official after party Friday night at the House of Blues, and that'll be a tribute to Toussaint, and the proceeds from that will benefit his foundation.
Now, how do we get around and where does the festival run? You mentioned Spanish Plaza. Does it begin at Spanish Plaza and run the length of the riverfront?
Our boundaries generally are from Bourbon Street to the river and from Canal to Esplanade, and then including Spanish Plaza. So it's most of the French Quarter.
Uh-huh. And you have a new app to help us get around?
We do. Well, the app's been around for a while, but what is so awesome about our app is that it's one of our sponsors. It's a partnership with GE Digital. And GE has a program where they use their really incredibly talented interns, and the interns have been building our app. So in recent years, they're adding more bells and whistles and more interesting features. This year, we're really excited that the official festival app, which is free, will have navigation capabilities. So if you are looking for the Antoine's booth, you can punch it in and the GPS will take you there, which is awesome. So
cool. We're
making it easier for people to find all kinds of things within the festival. It's a big sprawling event in a big neighborhood. So we try and make it easier. And then in addition, the festival shuttle comes back this year. So, you know, the city grants a neighborhood closure. And so we'll have people parking at the convention center and then riding a free shuttle into the festival. French Quarter Festival is a little uppity, but we kind of like it that way. You know, it's a lot of attention to just celebrating the great neighborhood that we live and work in.
What do you mean by a little uppity?
The fact that our food vending is fine dining. I mean, just really, you're eating oysters bonfam. I mean, it's like classic cuisine. And just the music, I mean, the traditional jazz, it's like the best of the best of the best. It's just really, really fine, amazing, high-quality music.
French Quarter Festival spokeswoman Marcy Schramm, thanks.
Thank you.
The 33rd annual French Quarter Festival, presented by Chevron, runs Thursday through Sunday. More info can be found online at fqfi.org. Uptown, a performance is planned at Tulane University this week that brings ancient Greek tragedy to modern-day veterans. Eileen Fleming reports it's also a public health project.
When Marshall Chevron heard about the Theater of War production, he immediately understood the relevance. The former commander of the New Orleans Veterans of Foreign Wars post once studied the classics.
It made perfect sense to me because even though the implements of war have changed a lot since the days of Sophocles, the elemental combat experience is the same, and the issues that returning warriors deal with are elementally the same.
Chevron says the VFW spread the word that the production was looking for local participation, and members responded. The person coordinating the Theater of War show is Tulane University Classics Professor Michael Brumbaugh. He's been working for 2 years with Outside the Wire Productions, which describes itself as a social impact company. Theater of War has been performed more than 300 times throughout the United States, Europe, and Japan. Venues include military sites from the Pentagon, Guantanamo Bay, VA hospitals, homeless shelters, and high school auditoriums. Actors read excerpts from Sophocles, panelists discuss how their experiences reflect the message, and then a town hall session begins to allow audience participation. Here's an excerpt from an earlier production highlighting a part of the Sophocles story of Ajax.
This much I know. If Achilles still lived and decided to hold a contest for his arms, awarding them to the greatest warrior at the end of the day, they would be mine.
Brumbaugh gives a little background for those unfamiliar with the story.
Ajax goes to the Trojan War, and he is widely regarded. He is a big, massive, imposing, physically imposing figure, and he is widely regarded as the greatest of the Greek warriors, except for Achilles. After Achilles dies, Ajax naturally assumes that he will now rise to become the greatest of the Greeks, bar none. And the Greek army on the shores of Troy hold funeral games after Achilles dies, and the big prize at these games is Achilles' armor. Ajax expects to win this prize, and symbolically, by taking Achilles' armor, taking his role as the best warrior. Instead, another hero, Odysseus, well known to many from Homer's Odyssey, Odysseus wins Achilles' armor despite the fact that he is not. I mean, he's a powerful hero, but he doesn't hold a candle to Ajax. And he wins because he's cunning and tricky, and he swoops in and wins the armor. And Ajax feels robbed. He feels like he's been cheated, and that everything that he knows about what's important about being a hero and a man and a warrior is sort of slipping away from him, because how could someone who doesn't have those characteristics that he has become the best of the Greeks? And this triggers an identity crisis for him.
There's also a powerful female story in that.
A very important character in Sophocles' play is Tecmessa. Tecmessa is Ajax's war bride, and she is caught in a really difficult place. She is very close to Ajax, and closer to Ajax than his comrades. She, unlike a lot of portrayals of Greek women in ancient literature, she exerts a lot of power and shows a lot of poise and intelligence in the play, and she realizes that Ajax's identity crisis really puts her in a very difficult position, because now she's alone and she doesn't have standing in the community without her husband because of the way Greek society works. She's now totally isolated, and she's trying to hold together her relationship with Ajax and also trying to look ahead to what's going to happen to her if he has a total breakdown.
And the production is meant to trigger discussions with present-day veterans and their families about how they were affected by war.
It will be an emotional as well as intellectual experience. I think that most people find it very cathartic, that it allows them a way to open up and interact with what are sometimes feelings that they might not feel safe discussing or thinking about or having a conversation about.
The local panel will include a researcher with the Tulane Medical School and Veterans Administration, three veterans, and the wife of a combat veteran. Theater of War begins at 7 p.m. Thursday at Dixon Hall at Tulane University. For WWNO Inside the Arts, I'm Eileen Fleming.
You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. A curious exhibit at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art is bound to turn heads and spark conversation. Arthur Kern, the surreal world of a reclusive sculptor, is currently on view. Kern is a retired Tulane art professor who withdrew from the outside world decades ago, spending much of his time creating art in his basement. Art he never intended to exhibit, that is, until he crossed paths with John Berendt, best-selling New York Times author of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, who curated his show. Both are here. Gentlemen, welcome to Inside the Arts.
Thank you.
This is an exhibit that we may never have seen. What made you, Arthur, change your mind and come out of seclusion?
Well, I think I was almost talked into it by the people from the Ogden and John. John was very enthusiastic, and I felt if he was going to be the curator, it would probably go smoothly, which it did. I guess it was about time that I began showing.
John, how did you connect with Arthur?
Well, a friend of mine is a cousin of Arthur's and happened to be over at her house and saw some photographs of some of Arthur's sculptures, asked what they were about, and he was taken over to Arthur's house. This is Robson Lutz, who used to be the director of the health department here. But anyway, he was very much turned on by it, and he called me right away, and he said, "What are you doing for lunch tomorrow?" And I said, "Nothing." And he said, "I'd like to show you something." So he took me over to Arthur's house, and I was astonished by what I saw. Beautiful sculptures all over the place, on shelves and tabletops and mantelpieces, etc. Arthur had been creating these sculptures over a period of about 40 years, and wasn't interested in selling, so they just accumulated there. Anyway, I was very struck by them, and I immediately called a friend of mine, Allison Kendrick, who was the chairman of the Board of Trustees at the Ogden Museum. I said, "You got to see this, because I think it would be a wonderful exhibition." And when she saw Arthur's pieces, she felt just as I did, and she brought the director of the museum and the head curator over to see what they thought, and they were wildly enthusiastic. And they asked me to be the guest curator, which is something I've never done before, but it was a delightful experience.
So, author, let's go back in time. Tell us your story. Why did you decide to drop out of the art world socially?
There was so much peripheral things going on in the art world, the openings, parties, and I felt it was impeding my work rather than helping. So I just decided to pull back and to be quiet. I feel like ideas are very subtle sometimes. They're very quiet when they speak to you. And I needed quiet to work. So I found that I just work much better when I'm alone and without any help. I do my thing.
And this happened after you retired as an art professor from Tulane?
Actually, it happened before that. It started to happen. When I returned to Tulane to teach, I had been a student there years before. I had a couple of exhibitions which were well received, and after several years, I just became kind of weary of those things. That's when I started to kind of pull back. And by the time that I retired, I was out of the loop, so to speak, completely.
You started teaching art in Southwest Louisiana?
Yes. We had been living in Pennsylvania, and I was working in an industry as a designer just to make a living, also painting and drawing at the time. But in 1967, I took a position at the University of Southwest Louisiana in Lafayette, Louisiana, to teach mainly drawing. And 2 years later, Tulane offered me a position where I taught painting and drawing until I retired in 1996.
You said you were painting and drawing, but there's no evidence of your work anymore.
No, I destroyed most of it. That was a habit of mine throughout my life, and still is, actually. I guess until I began making sculpture, I considered what I did practice. It was like doing homework, and you don't keep your homework normally. When I began making sculpture, I believe I felt a lot more comfortable with what I did. I don't know if it was just the result of maturing or the result of beginning to work three-dimensionally.
Would you say you're a perfectionist?
That's what I'm told, yes. In the realm of art, what's it all about if it isn't about doing the best that you possibly can?
Now, you have a family, a wife, and
yes,
children.
Right.
Did they think it odd that you spent so much of your time, years, decades, creating art that you never planned to exhibit?
No, I don't think they did. They probably thought it was just something, that's what Dad does. You know, he makes these things and puts them around the house.
And you're there in the basement, perhaps listening to music and creating?
I often listen to music. At least I will begin my day listening to music. But after I'm into my work a while, I don't hear the music anymore or anything else. I think it's a matter of focusing in on what I'm doing, and what's in my peripheral vision or hearing just tends to disappear.
Your subject matter is the human figure and horses. Tell us about your inspiration for these works and what you're exploring in the pieces.
I'm not sure why I began with horses. I think it was a nice foil to play the human figure against. So I think even the horse sculptures, even the ones that don't have, for instance, a rider, seem to intimate a human presence somehow.
But these are exquisitely made sculptures, and I think Arthur's taken months in some of them to get the patina just right on the outside, get the shape of the horse right, and the patina as well. And some of the horses appear to be made of pewter or marble, leather, or cloth. So, and he's able to achieve all of these different textures with using fiberglass or polyester resins. So, and it's quite a feat to do it and make each piece convincing.
These are large, life-size sculptures.
Some are, yes, some are life-size. Some are no more than about 10 or 12 inches high.
John, can you describe for us a couple of the pieces that really drew you in?
There's a self-portrait that more or less summarizes Arthur's approach. It's a torso and face, and it's sort of white. Looks very much like it had been carved out of marble. However, there are some holes knocked in the skull, and you can see behind the outer shell of the sculpture, as I described it, there's another one inside. Now, the outer shell was this pale white marble, but the cracks in the pale white marble showed a full-color person in there with an eye that looks absolutely real. Another one is a large horse, a black horse. The rider is probably female. It's a hooded rider, and the hood turns into robes, and so you don't see any part of the body of the rider. It's very mysterious. You look in, and there's no face. It's just dark. It's an arresting piece.
I never have any specific notion about what my work means. The meaning of a work of art comes from a dialogue between a viewer and the work of art. It's my job as a sculptor to have a dialogue of some kind with the thing I'm making. It often speaks back to me.
There seems to be a surreal element here mixed with elegance and the macabre at the same time. Can you explain the distortion in the figures that you create?
I guess I don't think of them as so much as distortions as I do reality. Not necessarily that things look that way, but the art object is probably something like a metaphor for what happens in reality, and after all, as human beings, we're pretty distorted.
What do you think people will be talking about long after seeing these works?
They might be asking questions. What's it all about? Why is it here? If that happens, then it has served a purpose, I think.
Sculptor Arthur Kern and curator John Behrendt, also known for his best-selling novel, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Arthur Kern, the surreal work of a reclusive sculptor, is on view at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art through July 17th. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.